order. Members, the first bill is the department policy bill, Senate file 2701, and we're going to have the department start going through that, and we've got some people who want to testify on. There's at least two provisions in there that there's some angst about. Article 1, Steve Krinkle.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Cadoon, okay.
Just for our policy bill, just on the agenda, the testifiers are actually out of order, so we'll be starting with the ones that are listed under the technical bill. So we'd start with Mark Peterson.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, too, we do have a few amendments regarding this, and I think it might be helpful if we just get to the amendments when we get to that article,
okay.
If that would be okay.
Mr. Peterson. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mark Peterson. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue. I'll go through Article 1. Section 1, all employers and others who withhold income tax from payments are required to issue statements to the payees, generally in the form of a W-2 or 1099. And all of those folks who do the withholding are required to file an annual reconciliation and submit the W-2 or 1099 copy to the Department of Revenue by the end of February of each year. And all of that withholding reconciliation and all those 1099s and W-2s are submitted to the department on the same forms at the same time. Many persons who issue those statements are required to file those electronically. The thresholds have been falling for a number of years. There are 50 for the ones that are due this year. It's 25 for the ones that are due in 2010, and it drops to 10 in 2011 and thereafter. And we're striking some old language out of the obsolete language from some of the older years, but otherwise we're not changing those thresholds in this bill. What we are doing is making a change to clarify that all of those 1099s and W-2s are aggregated in determining whether those thresholds are made. And Section 2 amends the law so that the mailing of notice of refund will stop the running of interest if the Department of Revenue determines that a address that the taxpayer has given us is invalid or is no longer current. Under current law, the mailing of the actual warrant itself stops the running of the interest. Now, this notice, we're required under current law to issue notices of determination on refunds. Usually that comes with the warrant, and if you had a refund, it's like you asked for $500, you get $500. That's usually the determination. And the reason we're proposing this change is our experience from last year when we were required to, we were told by the post office that in order to get the best mailing rates on the bulk mailings, that we were required to run old addresses through a change of address to determine if they were still valid. And really that applies whenever we're mailing bulk refund warrants that are more than 60 or 90 days old, which meant property tax refunds, which are typically filed way before 60 or 90 days. And last year we found about 700 refunds and about $250,000 of refunds that were to no address. If there's a change of address, we get that through the service, but there's no address. And the proposal would be that the notice that we would send out would be the would stop the interest from running. That's Article 1.
Any questions, members? Mr. Peterson, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'm Susan Berry from the Department of Revenue, and I'll do the sales tax article. The first section is regarding claims for refunds on behalf of purchasers. The current law does not have a timeline by which a seller who is claiming a refund on behalf of a purchaser must credit or refund that refund back to the purchaser, and this amendment provides that the seller who is claiming this refund on behalf of the purchaser must return to the commissioner within 60 days of the issuance of the refund any amount that has not been credited or refunded back to the purchaser. So this provides a trigger date by which they must do that or give the money back. Sections 2 and 3 are regarding seller and purchaser relief from liability. And these amendments are made to conform to the streamlined sales tax agreement of which the state is a member. It amends it so that if the legislature enacts a new sales tax rate, but the effective date does not give people at least 30 days, Then, for up to 30 days, the sellers will be relieved from liability to the state for failing to collect tax at the new rate. They would still have to collect the sales tax at the old rate, but they wouldn't be held liable for the difference. And this is providing that, like I said, they do continue to impose the old tax, and also that they don't solicit purchasers at the old rate. And then there's similar liability relief allowed for the purchasers. The fourth section is regarding special laws and local taxes. This is not regarding local sales tax. This is regarding other local laws, such as local taxes on lodging, entertainment, admissions, food and beverages, entertainment taxes, and so on. If the special law grants the local government the authority to impose the local tax, such as the lodging tax, and if the Department of Revenue is going to be administering this tax, such that the tax is going to be reported and paid along with the sales tax reported on the same return, then the definitions that are adopted by the local government must be the same as they are for sales tax. What happens right now is that what's adopted is not consistent with those definitions or the same transactions under the sales tax chapter.
Thank you.
And this creates inconsistencies in the application of the taxes. And it confuses not only the auditors when they're trying to audit for this, but also the retailers when they're trying to administer the special local taxes, because they have to follow two different sets of laws for the same transactions. So to avoid such issues, they would have to use the same definitions. This is not retroactive, so that those laws that are currently on the books, they would not have to change anything. However, if they were to come back and amend their laws, or for any new laws out there, if the commissioner is going to be administering them, then their definition would have to be consistent. And that's the end of the article.
Questions, members? Senator Scheid.
Well, Mr. Chairman, about Section 3. Forgive me. Section 2 and I guess 3. It's just, why are we worrying about that?
Why are we worrying about
it? If the legislature raises a sales tax and there's not, and the effective, we enact it, and then within less than 30 days, it goes into effect. I mean, it's almost like somebody had too much time to think. I don't get it.
Well, we don't think that this will be a problem for Minnesota, because we typically do allow people more than 30 days.
Oh, Mr. Chairman.
But if there is less than 30 days, if you're telling them that they have to administer this within a week or whatever after you've enacted it, or upon final enacted, the next day they have to start charging, then the practicality is that they don't have time to get their systems working. And so, and as I said, this is meant to conform with the streamlined sales tax agreement.
Mr. Chairman, I realize that. Yeah, somebody did have too much time to think, but it wasn't you guys. It was them. Okay, thanks. Thanks.
Any other questions, members? Thank you, Ms. Bray.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Pat Finnegan. I'll take you through Article 3, the special taxes article. Sections 1 and 3 are similar in that the department is seeking the authority to cancel inactive distributor licenses. Section 1 deals with petroleum distributor licenses, and Section 3 deals with cigarette and tobacco distributor licenses. It's especially important in relation to the cigarette and tobacco one, in that if an entity has a license, they're able to obtain untaxed cigarettes from out of state and bring them into Minnesota. So we want to be able to cancel these licenses if they're not reporting to the department. Sections 2 and 4 deal with the cigarette sales tax. And what we're trying to do there is just change the date of the annual survey to a non-legislative time of the year. Right now, we do the survey in the spring and publish the new rate by May 1st, effective August 1st. And our research department is involved with a lot of legislative matters during that time. So what we'd rather do is switch it to the fall, have the survey done then with the publication date November 1st and effective January 1st. There is an amendment that I believe that deals with Section 5.
Mr. Chair, there's an amendment, A10-2081, that deals with the surplus lines for gross premiums. We had worked with the Surplus Lines Association regarding this language, and this is something that we'd agreed on with them as well as with the Department of Commerce. So we'd like to see this good put on if we could.
Which one is it?
Yeah.
Senator Scoy moves the A10. It's in your packet.
They're all A10s, I think.
Oh, A10-2081.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
You sure?
I think she didn't match up to.
Ms. Cadoon?
There's another. That will explain in a minute. I'd also just like to mention that, like I said, we did work this out with the Surplus Lines Association. However, I have heard just yesterday regarding, I think, a client of Kathy Haney's that they did have some potential concerns with the language, did indicate we'd continue to, we'd meet with them to hear what their concerns was. So there might be something forthcoming on this as well after we meet with them.
Mr. Chairman, sections five.
Well, we should. Senator Scoy moves the amendment, 810-2081. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Mr. Finnegan, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, sections 5, 6, and 7 deal with the insurance tax. Section 5 was the one where the amendment was just adopted. That deals with the gross premiums definition. And what we're doing there is just reorganizing the statute, and then the amendment adds a specific language of gross premiums for the surplus lines tax. Section 6 then simply deletes language that would now be covered in Section 5. And Section 7 is it deals with the statute of limitations for assessing insurance taxes, normally 3.5 years after filing. And here the department's seeking authority, like we have in many of the other taxes, when there's an omission in excess of 25% to extend the statute of limitations. That's Article 3.
Questions on Article 3, members? Thank you, Mr. Finnegan.
Mr. Chair, for Article 4, I'll speak to the first sections of Sections 1, 2, and 8 in Article 4, which is the property tax section. This is the assessor language, which I know is one that you're maybe hearing there's a little bit more opposition and controversy to this section. We brought this, I'll just explain a little background on it. This really deals with the job responsibilities and role of assessors regarding property tax appeals. Why the department obviously puts this in our bill is that the Department of Revenue does staff the State Board of Assessors, appoints the members, and obviously has oversight role over the property tax system. We believe it's really very important for the legislature to be able to consider some recent tax court cases that made some decisions regarding the role of property tax assessors, their roles and responsibility when there's appeals and when these cases get to tax court. There's just been a very long-standing practice and understanding that part of the job responsibilities of an assessor was to testify in court regarding the valuation of property for property tax purposes. It's been the position of the Department of Revenue, the State Board of Assessors, and like I said, there's a long-standing understanding that preparing appraisal reports, testifying in court, are the normal duties of a licensed assessor. And the idea is that the assessor's roles and responsibilities include all aspects of the assessment and process, including real estate appeals. There was recent tax court cases this summer and fall that looked at this issue and really put a stop to this long-standing practice of the role of the assessor. the tax court, in a sense, ruled that preparing appraisal reports and testifying in court on property tax appeals after the tax has initially been assessed were not part of the assessor's duties, and that their testimony should not be included in tax court as well as any subsequent appraisals. The reason for the tax court decision really hinged on a section that's in Section 2 of this bill, which dealt with the moonlighting provision for assessors. This statute was put in, this moonlighting prohibition was put into law in 1993. At that point, it was the Department of Revenue's position, and the idea behind it was to prohibit moonlighting by assessors. The idea is you don't want assessors to be able to assess properties in their taxing jurisdiction and then on the side do moonlighting for a private appraisal. Obviously, we thought that would kind of undermine the integrity of the tax system as well as undermine taxpayer trust. We still think that moonlighting provision is very important, still think it should remain. But what happened is in tax court, this was looked at and advocated and argued that the language of the statute would prohibit assessors from making appraisal of properties and then, in a sense, then be able to testify in court regarding that subsequent appraisal for a property tax appeal. What the tax court said is under the plain language of the statute that they agreed with that argument, and so assessors were then prohibited from appearing as expert witnesses, and their appraisal reports were prohibited from being included in the tax appeal. As you know, they look at the plain language of the law. If the plain language that they look at is enough, they said, we don't have to look at legislative intent. Well, we obviously knew what the legislative intent was. The record shows that back in 1993. We know it was to prevent moonlighting, not to prohibit tax assessors from testifying in court. So the result of this is now for property tax disputes, counties are going to have to hire outside appraisers. That would obviously increase costs to the counties as well as to the taxpayers within the county. We believe, and what our sections 1, 2, and 8 would do, is to go back and say that, no, this longstanding practice of assessors for their roles and responsibilities should remain as it's always been. They should be able to do one of their core job functions of providing appraisals and testimony in court when there is a dispute or evaluation for property tax purposes. So that's the intent of Section 1, 2, and 8. What it would do as well is still the courts would still have the discretion they currently have regarding testimony, that they'd be able to allow it in or not, and they'd be able to determine if the assessor should be considered a lay witness or expert. They'd still have the same discretion they've had before, which is to determine how much value to give to that testimony and how much value to give to those reports and appraisals. So that's, in essence, what Section 1, 2, and 8 do. There is also an amendment regarding the effective dates, and I don't know if you'd want to offer that as well. It's 8, 10, 21, 30. And what the effective date change would be is really to make sure that we know there's at least one court, there's one appeal currently, and we want to make sure that any law change doesn't impact any court's cases that are currently on appeal. And so what this language change would do for the effective date is say it's just going to be effective for any cases that have not currently gone to trial.
Well, members, let's get the language in the shape the department wants it here. I think that's a reasonable request, but there is definitely some angst on this provision that we're going to have to spend a little bit more time on. Senator Scoy moves to A-10-21-30. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Contrary, no. The motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair, I also have an amendment to this provision. It's the A-2 amendment. It deals with interest at the being collected. There was a change in law last year that had an unintended consequence. It was requiring local governments to pay a higher interest than they had in the past. And Mr. Carlson is here to talk about it. I've talked to the department. I think they're supportive of this change.
Ms. Kadoon, does the department support the amendment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, yes, we do. We're supportive of this amendment. We know this was an inadvertent change that occurred, not inadvertent, but it was carried in a different bill. I don't think people realize that it also, for this interest rate change, had also then impacted property tax appeals for, in a sense, it changed the interest rate. I think currently that it was at like a 5% to now a 10% for these cases. We know this did obviously then raise costs to the counties as well as to the state. Just so you know, too, this provision then will have a budget implication. It will actually be positive now to the general fund. So it will show a positive gain to the general fund by now reducing that 10% rate to something lower.
Mr. Carlson, would you like to testify to this?
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson with the Minnesota Intercounty Association. Ms. Cadoon accurately described this. This was a provision that was placed in the public safety finance bill last year with the intent of applying to insurance settlements, but the way it was drafted, it applied to every judgment, including both property tax reductions for the taxpayer, as well as property tax increases for the taxpayer if he or she is so unfortunate to have appealed their valuation and actually have the tax court increase the value above what the assessor. What it does is reduce the interest rate from 10% on judgments over $50,000 to the current floating rate of 4%. So for $50,000, you would be talking about a $3,000 difference.
Members, this actually was the bill that this unintended consequence came out of was a bill that I actually was the author of. It was heard in Senator Scheid's committee and Senator Moy's committee, and it was an issue of where a commercial insurance company withholds payment to a policyholder. The way the law, I believe, was written, if the policyholder prevailed, the interest rate they got was the Treasury market rate, I believe. And on behalf of the policyholders, they felt that that a higher interest rate might try to drive settlements. And somehow the language, the way the language was written, and we got this unintended consequence of impacting property tax, property tax appeals also, and refunds.
Okay,
so, Senator Moy, do you remember the issue? I think I remember well enough. It was House filed 528. It was
Mr. Chairman. Whose bill was this?
the original bill that passed into law and was signed was authored by me and by Representative Atkins.
Yes. Yeah.
But I wasn't aware that it also was included in Senator, who had the public safety bill. It got included in one of the omnibus bills also, which I wasn't aware
Senator
of.
Senator Higgins and Representative
right.
Paymar.
That's right. That's right.
So it ended up in more than
That's
one
right.
place.
Mr.
Senator Pogemiller.
Which one should it not have been in?
Well, there was a standalone.
Is this a tax issue or is this? It seems to me one of the bills should not have had it. And I'm just curious which one. So perhaps I could mention that to that chair.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it was a standalone bill that went through Judiciary and through Commerce relative to insurance companies, and somehow it got into another omnibus bill, I think, and I think that's where it created the problem. Senator Double?
I think you're right.
Mr. Chair, I don't think it necessarily was in its conception a tax bill. But it had implications for right. these
right.
property tax appeals, unbeknownst, an unintended consequence. But it didn't originate. It originated as a consumer protection idea.
It was an insurance. Yeah, consumer protection would be a good way to characterize it. It was never in the tax. It was never intended to delve into the tax arena.
Should,
Senator Pogemiller.
Should it have gone to the tax committee?
Well, Senator Pogemiller, not the way the language looked to me.
Right.
Ms. Cadoon?
Mr. Chair, I think what happened with this bill is I think people didn't realize that the property tax appeal section that dealt with the interest rate referred back to the language that was being amended or changed in this other bill. And so it just didn't realize that our property tax appeals actually referenced that area.
Just through a reference.
Just through a reference, right.
Yeah, it's okay.
On the Skoy Amendment, Senator Skoy moves adoption of the A2. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tide.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question, and I know you said there were some concerns about this, but I just wanted to get something straight that I don't think is – I'm not sure that it's a major concern that, you know, or it causes any angst. But there's – it looks to me like we don't require assessors to be licensed because it says nothing shall be construed as requiring it. And as you look down here, it says a licensed assessor or other person employed by an assessment jurisdiction. So, again, it doesn't look like you have to be licensed to be an assessor. I don't know if that's an issue for anybody. I'm not trying to make it an issue. But then Section 8 talks about an appraisal prepared by a licensed assessor in Section 8. And so it's, which is it? Do they need to be licensed or not? And are most of them, and it was a grandfather thing, or what is the deal?
Mr. Halligan?
My question.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, in actual fact, assessors do have to be licensed. There's the assessors came up with a licensing program began in 1971.
Okay,
they developed three levels of licensure, which was increased again, I believe, about 1986. The licensure they're referring to, I believe, in that provision is a commerce license, which appraisers now are required to have since 1989, I believe that was implemented. So assessors are licensed by the State Board of Assessors. Appraisers are licensed by the Department of Commerce.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, so that language that says nothing shall be construed as requiring the licensing of persons and acting in their capacity as assessors is really not accurate? I mean, maybe nothing in the chapter does, but it does kind of infer. That's in the very first language of the first section of Article 4. And then it's called. And so that Section 8 is fine, but Sections 1 and 2 of the article are kind of, I'm not sure I understand why there may be people described who are not licensed who are doing this job then. But I just thought I'd wondered if there was an inconsistency that's a problem or if it's just old language that should be cleaned up.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, before we make a final pass on this, is there anyone from the appraisal industry that might have an opinion on this bill?
I know, Senator Limmer, we have some people that want to testify on this provision.
All
so
right.
I guess we'll find out what they have to say.
Right.
Mr. Hogan?
If I might try to clarify again, Mr. Chairman, Senator Scheid, the provision that you're referring to, I believe, is the 82B statute that provides for licensing of appraisals, the commerce licensing statutes. The assessor licensing statutes are in the 270s. So when they're saying that nothing should prohibit persons preparing an appraisal, that's basically dealing with the moonlighting provision where assessors can testify in court without being licensed as an appraiser.
Okay. I just have to read it separately, and I'm fine. I mean, I think I understand, but I don't think it's real important to the debate. I just was curious.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I think as we begin to expand this discussion into
that's appraising.
Who would be the appropriate expert to testify in court, that may trigger at least this provision going to Judiciary Committee. Ultimately, the court will have to recognize the professional expertise of whoever gives testimony in a courtroom. And I would hope that we could keep that in the hands of a judge rather than perhaps make the law so tight from a tax committee that it takes away the discretion of a court. Minnesota has quite a history of allowing our judges to have wide discretion in applying the expertise and testimony in a courtroom. And I hope we don't go too far afield that we would tie the hands of a court.
I think the issue, Senator Limmer, is because of a recent decision by the court. I think the long practice of giving that judicial discretion has now, pendulum probably has swung the other way. Ms. Cadoon, is that accurate?
That
Mr. Chair, that's accurate. They're reading that moonlighting prohibition for assessors to say that now assessors cannot testify in court. What our language would do is say to make sure that the assessors are allowed to testify and still have the tax court have the discretion to determine how if they should be considered an expert witness or if they should be considered a lay witness. And also they still have that same discretion the tax court would have, the same discretion to determine how much weight and value to give to that assessor's testimony. Right. That would still remain under our language.
Mr. Chair, you know, in a perfect analytical world, if you had two appraisers appraising the same property based on the same background information for comparables, you should have the same general conclusion. Likewise, if a tax assessor is doing the same thing in comparison to a privately hired appraiser for the purposes of giving testimony or some expert validation for the homeowner, you also should have the same value if everything's fair. But the reason why you're in a courtroom is that there's a dispute between value. And I don't know if that's reflective of the licensure or the tax assessor status alone, but I think this needs to be ferreted out a little bit more. And maybe our appropriate Commerce or Judiciary Committee should take a look at this.
Mr. Hagan, anything further?
Mr. Chair, I don't know if you'd like us to finish Article 4 before you take testimony?
Yep.
Okay.
My name is Harriet Sims from Minnesota Department of Revenue, and I will be going through the rest of the sections of Article 4. And we're starting with Section 3, and this deals with a situation where assessors are required to appraise at least one-fifth of all the parcels in the district or county during the year, and the statutory consequence of not doing that is that the commissioner would be required to order a reappraisal of all the property in the district, which is something that doesn't happen very often, and it is quite expensive. Our proposed change would be to make that duty discretionary in that the commissioner could order a reappraisal, but in situations where there are extenuating circumstances, for instance, there was a flood and the assessor couldn't get to all of the properties in that particular year, then the commissioner would not necessarily have to order a reappraisal, or in a situation where more assessor education or other methods might be a better way to handle the issue. Sections 4 and 5 then deal with property tax exemptions specifically. These would require churches and schools to file an initial property tax exemption application in order to be exempt. It would not apply to properties that are already exempt, and it would be only a one-time filing, and this would be effective for taxes payable in 2012. Section 6 deals with the wind energy property tax non-filer calculation. That currently, under current law, if a wind energy production tax taxpayer does not file a return, does not tell us how many kilowatt hours they have, we use a default calculation of 40% of nameplate capacity. What we found is that as more and more of these wind towers go online, the efficiency is getting better. So the ones that are coming online now, I understand, are between 35 and 45%. So if you've got one that's about 40% or a little over 40%, you would have a taxpayer that would actually get a better deal by not filing than by filing. The reason we are raising it, the default tax calculation, to 60%, because that's currently, under current technology that's as efficient as it can get. And so this would be effective for the reports due on February 1st. Their reports are due on February 1st, and then we need to get the information to the counties by February 28th.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I, this is a good approach, and I support it. But I'm just curious why the decision made not to just, when someone fails to file, not just penalize them outright. I mean, it sounds like something that shouldn't be happening regardless. I mean, I get kind of this kind of mechanism to incent their filing, but why not nick them with a naughty letter and you have a little penalty to pay for failing to file the actual power produced?
I guess how often do people not file?
Senator Bach, I'm not exactly sure exactly how many. Very few don't file. We know of one instance where the person just did not file at all, and we used the 40%. We know of other instances where they were late in filing, and in that situation, we grant them the extra time, and we use the information that they give us if they're 10 days late. I think in one situation, they were even beyond the date that we, you know, sent the information to the county, and we had to make a change on that. We have to get about 400 of these out in about a month's time. So even if somebody didn't file and we gave them the penalty, they still might not file. The penalty, when you count up the penalty with the lower nameplate capacity, that might not be, you know, that might not really be enough. It may still behoove them not to file.
Well, Mr. Chair, just
Turnable.
I mean, it just seems like anyone who doesn't file is breaking the law. So, you know, okay. So I mean, I understand this mechanism, but it's a curious approach.
But curious, but probably necessary.
Right, it's a good approach. I like it.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, on this type of penalty system, we're basically increasing by what, 30%? The penalty fee, is that how I interpret this?
Well, Senator Limmer, Bach, this isn't really a penalty. In fact, it's not a penalty at all. It's a default calculation because we don't have the information in order to calculate the tax. It's more analogous to a commissioner-filed return. If somebody doesn't file their return for income tax, we make up a return for them based on what information we have. Then that taxpayer is then free to do their own return with the correct information. In this situation, if somebody does not give us the information, we will have to make some assumptions as to what their capacity is in order to let the counties know what that should be. If it winds up being too high, they can tell us what the real number is.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm trying to figure out, maybe you could explain to me, if the owner of a wind energy conversion system fails to file a report, as it says in this amendment, then the commissioner shall determine the tax. So is there no tax up to that point, or is this a separate add-on tax for failing to report?
Senator Limmer, Chairman Bach, if I think I understand the question, it's whether using the 40% currently or the 60% currently is an add-on to the tax, and it's not. The tax is calculated based on what the wind tower's capacity is, and currently it could be, if it's very inefficient, it might be 20 or 30%. If it's a newer one and it's more efficient, it might be 35 or 40%. The 60% that we propose to use is for two reasons. Number one, it's an incentive for them to give us the correct numbers, so we won't use 60%. And it's also trying to get a little bit ahead of the curve, so we won't be coming back, have to keep coming back as these towers get more and more efficient.
Mr. Chair, I guess I read this as not a carrot. It seems to me to be a stick to force complying of a report. But with the backdrop of trying to encourage alternative energy sources such as windmills, which I think, in my own personal opinion, are rather inefficient in comparison to the demand that we have to satisfy. But nevertheless, if we're exploring the ideas from a public policy perspective of trying to encourage alternative energy sources to develop and flourish and improve, is this stick approach the right way to encourage a business toward alternative energy?
Senator Limmer and Chairman Bach, we think it is because the businesses are already in the business of alternative energy. This makes it, we believe that this corrects an anomaly or a potential anomaly in the system that we already have. We certainly don't want to let taxpayers have a better deal or a lower tax if they don't file than if they do, and we think that corrects this, that this corrects that problem.
Mayor Limmer, it seems like the department's right about this.
Some are pondering the direction of the department, Mr. Chair.
It seems like saying, well, the assessor can't come on my property. I'll just kind of take my chances that that if I don't let them on, I might end up with a lower tax rate.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, then perhaps if we are going, if you think that we should go in this direction, is a 30% increase the necessary magic number to encourage compliance? Would a 10% increase be better as a shot over the bow instead of a 30% seems to me to be a large figure in one fell swoop.
I think we don't know the answer to the question of what is the capacity currently,
right,
versus when the 40% was put in law, what was the efficiency of a wind turbine versus what they are today. Certainly they've gotten better.
Well, Mr. Chair, on the description, it says the nameplate capacity. So somewhere on this machine is a plate that says the capacity that it's supposed to be operating at. And then that's a factor in multiplying by the 60% in order to determine the dollar amount that they're going to have to pay. Whether or not they're efficient up to that point, I'm not sure, or if there's no wind blowing at that particular time, that real capacity or output may really be in question.
And it may depend on where the tower was located.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Sims, thank you. Ms. Cadoon?
Continue on with the rest of the bill, Mr. Chair.
Is that the end of?
We have just two more sections.
Okay.
Section 7 deals with the manufactured home park cooperatives, and I know this is another one where we have some opposition to it. What this provision does is codify Department of Revenue's current interpretation of 273.124 regarding the manufactured home cooperatives. And the treatment of the co-ops was for these manufactured home parks was called to our attention by the counties. And we know the co-ops do disagree with their current interpretation, and we believed it was really very important to clarify this issue as more of these parks are now being created. The issue really deals with how the class rate and the market value credit are applied to the land owned by the cooperatives in these parks. The question is really, is the lower class rate and tier break of the homestead at the 1% versus the 1.25%? And the homestead market value credit applied to the land is in aggregate is owned by the co-op, or is it applied and somehow prorated on the individual lots that these manufactured home units would be on? Just some complicating factors and some reminders on for manufactured homes in general is that the home units in the park are personal property, whereas the land is real property. For personal property, you obviously have the tax that is assessed in January 2nd of this year, whereas the tax it's assessed and paid in the same year for personal property, whereas for real property, you have where the tax is assessed in 1 year and paid in the next. So that's kind of a complicating factor on how you would deal with the class rate for the land, as well as to the homestead market value credit. What the Department of Revenue's current interpretation is the class rate and homestead market value credit on would apply to the land as the whole and not on the individual units, is which I believe the cooperatives would like to see. We do plan on meeting with the co-ops on Thursday to discuss this and see if there's any sort of compromise that we can reach. Our concern, obviously, is we think it'd be very administratively difficult to do as they're suggesting. Like I said, we plan on meeting, and maybe there'll be some sort of a compromise or something that we can come forth with to the legislature on this issue.
So, Ms. Cadoon, what the language does is codify the department's current practice. Is that right?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I've had some conversation over the past yesterday and this morning about this, and I know we're going to have testimony. I think there's a dramatically different perspective on what's going on with this language change. I'm most interested in hearing, and we can perhaps get into this after we've heard the testimony, but I'm most interested in hearing how we treat other kinds of cooperative, you know, common interest communities, condos, associations, et cetera. It seems like we would then be treating these sorts of co-ops, which, you know, we've been striving to set up these kind of co-ops to preserve this kind of housing now for a few years, and now they're starting to happen, and then suddenly we're kind of shifting the rules, and frankly, I think a number of these, I think there are four or five around the state now, and that's a good thing. Their finances will become very, very unstable if this is enacted, so I'm really concerned, because I think there's growing agreement that these manufactured housing parks represent a significant element of affordable housing, and to be able to stabilize them and create ownership investment in them, improve them, that by their nature improves them quite dramatically. So it's kind of registering my concern. I'm interested in the testimony. I'm to preview, Mr. Chair, I'm interested in taking this section out, having them work out the agreement, and then bring it back to the committee.
My thought kind of is, in the interest of time, if we're going to take it out, we probably shouldn't bother with the testimony if it's not going to be in here. But I guess if we're going to leave it in and then let them work on it, we could probably have the testimony, but it might seem better to, if we're going to take it out, that we wait for the testimony until we come back and we've been able to reach some agreement.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll move to delete Section 7.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Cadoon, doesn't this issue kind of revolve around the actual ownership of the land and where the co-op owns the land as opposed to the individual person that owns the personal property? And it's a pretty significant departure that if we are not going to continue down the path that you're going on, it would be quite a departure from normal assessment practices to have the owners of the land. You get where I'm headed with this?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, yeah, that was another complicating factor that I neglected to mention, which is the ownership of, say, the individual unit for the manufactured home versus the land.
Yes.
That's the complicating factor that's different than probably some other real estate, which is you'd have one owner for the manufactured home, which they currently would get for the personal property. They also would be getting their homestead market value credit on that unit. And then how you would apply then whatever land which is owned then by the co-op in the aggregate, and how you would apply that market value credit for everybody else would be with the land and the unit together.
So Ms. Cadoon, how are like assessments paid relative to a cooperative piece of property? Who pays the assessment? If there's some assessments that the local government puts on the parcels.
See if Mr. Nord can answer this question, hopefully.
It's a separate entity.
Yes, but.
Mr. Chair, Jason Nord from the Department of Revenue.
Doesn't matter.
Because the cooperative is the owner of the park, then any assessment that's applied to the park is to be paid by the cooperative. So if any of the property tax or any of the assessments are not paid, then it isn't divisible where one lot forfeits but not the whole park. The whole park is subject to forfeiture or subject to an assessment. And so that's why the cooperative is directly the taxpayer, but in some of the other cooperatives, there's some communication directly with the shareholders about the taxes, but ultimately the cooperatives are the taxpayers and are liable for the taxes. And that's what makes the manufactured home co-ops different and makes it difficult for us to treat them equally with other cooperatives, is because in other cooperatives, it's all real property, whereas in a manufactured home co-op, there are personal property parcels and real property parcels. So how you join that up and make it all work out in the tax system is very difficult.
We could.
Senator Dibble.
But, Mr. Chair, the practical effect is, I appreciate the technical difference, but the reality is that these are very similar to other kinds of co-ops or condo associations, and currently, what allowing this tax rate to be delivered, this homestead tax rate to be delivered, to the underlying parcel on which a manufactured unit sits, allows them, of course, to both benefit from the tax credit, pay the 1% tax rate, starts to phase out after $76,000 and it goes away completely after $500,000. So it could conceivably take it entirely away for some of these folks. Keep in mind, some of these are very new deals as well, highly leveraged, and as the amortization schedule works out, they'll become less leveraged, of course, but it might throw some of these deals into significant disarray. Housing Finance Agency has some significant dollars to support some of these conversions to co-ops, from investor-owned rental types of circumstances. So, it would effectively just kind of knock some of these folks out of being able to consider the homestead rate and I don't see it as that distinct in a practical sense. So, if we can send them away to, we marry up their, the real property and the personal property concepts.
We may have a much smaller dispute than we think if the market value credit doesn't survive the session.
That's a good point.
Senator Scoy, if we delete this, could we get your committee to kind of work with the department and the manufactured owners and see if we can find some middle ground here?
Mr. Chair, that might be a pretty good solution. I've got hearing scheduled for the next couple of weeks, and I think we could work it in on the last week, and that'll give them a little time to work on it. And so, why don't we,
Ms. Cadoon, could you stay in touch with Senator Scoy, and maybe we can work this provision through his division, Senator Dibble?
And I serve on that, so.
Senator Dibble moves to delete Section 7. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. The motion prevails. And Ms. Cadoon, that's it, right? Or was there one more?
The last section,
which I will take you through, is Section 9 that deletes and updates some references within the law that allows a second installment of property taxes on agricultural property to be made on November 15th instead of October 15th. And this is due to the fact that we changed some of these classifications, and so we had to choose what to what property to refer to for the November 15th. And so the agricultural non-homestead property was in a different paragraph. So we have changed that. Fewer will qualify for the lower payment date, just because the number of properties that qualify for the agricultural treatment are lower. So this would be the only property that has the 2A classification would qualify.
Any questions on that? Senator Scoy, is that okay? Thank you, Ms. Sims. Let's have some testimony on this assessor issue. It seems like there's a little bit of work to be done there also, but I have on the list four people that are interested in testifying on it, and we need to keep it to about 5 minutes apiece. Steve Bidor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members. Again, my name is Steve Bidor. I'm a taxpayer who has firsthand experience of some of the repercussions, unintended consequences, when a county chooses to ignore Subdivision 5 and allow their assessors to act as appraisers in court. Let me just start with this is a direct impact on small businesses. It does not affect large businesses. The deck's already stacked against us in terms of a small business. And let me just illustrate, just using the county's own behavior as illustrated in the tax records. I went to the tax court maintains a website of all their filings. So I took 2008, 2009, and listed out every valuation case, and to see when do they use a MIA appraiser as their expert witness, and then when do they use their own assessor as an expert witness. If you have my attachment, my handout, page two lists all the cases that were decided in 2008 and 2009, and page two. I have mine backwards. And there are eight of those. And these are all cases in which the assessor did not act as the expert witness. Rather, the county hired an outside expert, and usually an MAI, the highest accreditation for appraisers. You'll notice that if you look down the taxpayer, these are primarily big businesses, General Mills, American Crystal Sugar. So when the county is up against a big business, they don't use their own assessors. They use MAI. They're already spending money for an outside witness. But look at the last column. What's the success ratio for a small business to get some relief in court? 63.2%. Go to the next page, page three. These list all the cases in 2008 and 2009 that went through the tax court in which the counties chose to have their own assessors act as the expert witness. Look at that success rate. Small businesses have a success rate in court of 11.1%. Now, I know my time is short, so I really can't get into some of the reasons and why this deck is stacked against small business. Mr. Chairman, to use your analogy of the pendulum swinging back, you are right, and it's amazing how many ways that ignoring Subdivision 5 allows a county to hold that pendulum up in their favor. There are unexpected ways, there are unusual ways, but also directly. Let me just back up again, staying with the big picture from 30,000 feet in terms of how a small taxpayer is disadvantaged in the system, especially with Subdivision 5 being ignored, you just look at the cost of admission for a taxpayer to go to court. On that first page, I map out $40,000 when you add the expert witness, because as a taxpayer, the court holds me to a higher standard than the county. I could be an MAI appraiser, and yet I'm not independent, so my testimony would have no weight in court. Yet a county, an assessor from the assessor's office, who is not independent, is allowed to testify, and that is given value. So I need to hire an MAA, which the litigation appraisal is about 12 grand, figure about a grand for testimony, the court reporter, attorney. So for 40 grand, I would need to have a ruling that a difference in valuation that is like $1.3 million in my favor in order to have any chance of recouping that. If you look at underneath that for a small business, drawing from the court's own data, the average disputed difference when the assessors defy Subdivision 5 is roughly $700,000. If you look at the odds of prevailing for the small business, it's 11%. So on average, the odds of getting relief puts it at maybe $46,000 of assessed value reduction, but only a tax value of $1,388. So there is no incentive. There is a huge disincentive for a small business to go to tax court. There's no way, in my case, I could ever recuperate my out-of-pocket cost. It's a lose-lose situation. And because the county has no out-of-pocket expense, they have no motivation, no incentive to not only not negotiate with me or talk to me, they have an incentive just to ignore me because they know I'll never go to court. It's too expensive. Contrast that with what a big business looks at. The average disputed difference for a big business is $10.7 million. Their average, their odds of relief, their odds of payback are $74,000. So a big business has an incentive. My case is one of three in which we challenged the county for violating Subdivision 5. So far, all three of the judges at tax court have been unanimous and consistent in agreeing that it is a violation, a prohibition of Subdivision 5 for an assessor to act as an appraiser in court. None of the decisions restricted or said that the county assessor's office they're still allowed to do pretrial negotiations, pretrial discussions. It just speaks to when it goes to trial, then the county's held to the same standard that I, the taxpayer, am. On my case as well, the county has appealed the court's decision. So right now it's in front of the Minnesota Supreme Court. So bring that to your attention. So I just want you to see with my limited time, the view from 30,000 feet, how from a small business standpoint, that pendulum is already hanging over me in the county side, and it is to a small business is a great disadvantage.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Bedore, for coming. And I've seen these documents before. You laid out the case pretty well for me. But for my colleagues here and those that are watching here, if I understand, if you go to tax court, you have to pay a private expert appraiser to testify about the valuation of the property. And currently under Minnesota law, the county does too. And Yet what is being proposed here now is to allow the counties not to have to hire an expert outside to come in with an expert appraisal, but rather they would get to use their own employee who may have been participating in the original assessment on behalf of the county, and so they may have a conflict when that same person is defending an assessment by the county. And then they also have the resources of the county, like the county attorney's office and everything else, to support what they do. So when you say the deck is stacked against you, you have all these expenses, and if we change this law, then the county doesn't. And that's creating an unfair advantage for the county in these cases and following. And if I remember what you said, the taxpayers have won in enforcing this provision now to say the county must have an outside independent expert. The Supreme Court has thrown out assessor testimony if they were not. Is that what happened in your case? They threw out
the
testimony?
No, the tax court threw it out. Now Hennepin County has raised the issue and would like the Supreme Court to weigh in on it. So the Supreme Court has not weighed in yet, but it's pending.
And, Mr. Chair, if I may, based on that, because the Supreme Court is reviewing this, I would hope that we would take this provision out at this time and not get in the middle of a case that is currently pending in the Minnesota court about how to apply this section in our tax appeals. And I hope the committee would support that. And I would move to take this section out for that reason.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
I'm very concerned. All of a sudden, I wasn't at first, but if he's got an open case, should he even be testifying?
I think, Senator Ertman, we amended the provision so it doesn't, or Senator Johnson, so that it doesn't apply to current cases.
Well,
Senator Ertman.
Mr. Chair, I think it would be wise for us to hear what the Supreme Court has to say about this issue. I'm concerned about the conflict, and if they see that there's a conflict, we shouldn't be changing this provision for cases going forward.
Yes, it says it doesn't apply to pending.
I just think we all need to understand something about this, and I think we'll have Senator Skoy spend some time on this too, is if we're going to require the local government unit to, in every case, to go get a private appraisal, we are putting a pretty serious burden on them relative to cost. I mean, well, I guess maybe we'll find out from the counties how many millions of dollars we're talking about, but Senator Ortman, the practice has been for assessors to testify until the recent court decision. So we just need to be a little careful here when all of us complain about property taxes and local government cost, when we put a new burden on them, requiring them to go out and get a private appraisal every time there's an issue in front of the court. We just need to understand what we're telling the county they need to do, Senator Ortman.
Well, Mr. Chair, I agree with that, but the taxpayer has to do a careful cost-benefit analysis to decide whether it's worth taking a case to court for the potential recovery. And I think the county should be in the same position to do the same cost-benefit analysis. How much will it cost to hire an expert to make their case? If the taxpayer is asked to do that, I think it's only fair that the counties be asked to do that. The counties already get free legal service through their county attorney. The residents don't get free legal service. They have to pay their attorney and the appraiser. So I think we're going to I think we should try and level the playing field here and not give the counties this added benefit and an extra burden on the taxpayer that they aren't willing themselves to carry.
But Senator Ortman, back to the pendulum issue, if we swing it over so that we just encourage more and more appeals, because everybody will realize that if they file an appeal, the county is not going to want to go out and get a private appraisal. In virtually every case, the county is going to lower the appraisal. I mean, there are people in this room that are going to go out and solicit appeals because virtually every parcel of property, it will make more economic sense for the county to just negotiate a lower appraisal rate than to go spend the money on another private appraisal. I mean, there is a balance here.
Well, Mr. Chair, the other point is perhaps maybe they will look closer at their assessments. so that they aren't putting out assessments that draw challenges. I mean, I think we should make sure that the pendulum is evened out here and that our taxpayers don't have this unfair burden. It's already current law. What's being proposed is to change it. Current law under in the Minnesota courts are actually enforcing the statute in favor of fairness. Why would we get in the middle of that while this court case is pending?
But Senator Ortman, it hasn't been the practice. The court's taken a new interpretation of the moonlighting provision that was put in law. What the department's proposing to do is to put into law what the current practice has been.
Well, Mr. Chair, unfortunately, we've got some litigants that have been successful, so now the counties come back to the legislature and ask for an entirely different answer because they don't like the answer that they got from the Supreme Court. And I think we should not get in the middle of that until they've identified for us whether an assessor would have a conflict, which is why we have the statute and why they've made those decisions.
So Senator Ortman moves to delete Article 4, Sections 1, 2, and 8. That effectively will take these provisions out of the bill. Senator Skoy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. You know, it isn't free for the counties to have county assessors. I mean, true, they are county employees, but it's not free. And the same with the county attorney. It's not a free service. It seems reasonable to me that if you have a county that has a county assessor's department and they're doing the work for the county, that they would be able to present that information in court. I see no rationale for them to have to go out and hire independent assessors. I just don't understand why we wouldn't let them to continue with the practice that they have been doing.
Senator Ortman.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I understand what happens, the assessment is admissible evidence. What you're not allowing then is somebody else from the county or that same assessor to then take it to that next level and say it qualifies as an appraisal and not just an assessment. That's the difference. But the taxpayer has to say, okay, here's the assessor, but an appraisal would come in at a different level, and that's why the county would have an advantage. The same guy gets to testify as both an assessor and an expert appraiser.
Let's, Senator Ortman, are you okay if we hear some more testimony before we vote on your motion?
Of course.
Mr. Chairman, if
Waddell,
I could,
quickly.
I have some research regarding cost, because you're concerned about the impact of this if you start to enforce Subdivision 5. If you look at the two-year history, the practice, the county is already hiring outside witnesses for 50% of the cases. So that's part of it. Now, to quantitate how many they actually would have to pay for if it was enforced, I count, I think it was 9 over a two-year period. So you're talking 4.5. If you want to take out per county, that means Dakota would be once a year, Hennepin County once and a half a year, Scott County every other year, Washington County once a year. So it's not a burdensome or a onerous thing. To the other senator's point about how this could be used, and I'll just point to one unintended consequence, which is, in my case, the assessor before trial, in discussion, and I have the email, verified that he's done his research on the comparables, and his research confirmed an $880,000 assessed value. Then, when it came time to exchange appraisals, the appraisal wasn't for 880. Suddenly, within a few-week period, the assessed value was inflated to 1.1 million. So from this taxpayer's viewpoint, it was a punitive measure to teach me, to put me in my place for taking them on. And unfortunately, I'm not the only one. Joel Hauser, a Midas muffler shop owner, Robert Fine. There are many examples, particularly in Hennepin County, where not having the outside cost enables them to further intimidate a taxpayer. If they're so concerned about cost, again, you look at trials, look at my trial. Mine's a little 2,000-3,000 square foot buildings. You'd think it'd be done in a day and a half. They kept my expert witness, who's on my nickel, in the court reporters on my nickel and the meters running with my attorney for 3 days. How many questions can you ask over 3 days regarding two little concrete buildings in Chanhassen? Again, I was forewarned before, but others have been through this before, other small businesses and people that serve them, that the counties can use this to bleed you to death if you go to trial because they don't have that out of pocket. My trial took 6 days. The General Mills trial for $65 million took 7 days. Mine for a property less than $1 million took 6 days. So in practice, what my experience is the counties aren't that concerned about cost, their internal cost, because we spent a day debating two aspects of my appraisal, my property, that both the county assessor and my MAA guy both virtually agreed to. The difference in tax was like $450. But a day was spent debating which one's more accurate. And it's like, well, that's over $20,000 of taxpayer money in that one day. So I'll just end with that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bedort. Steve Sinnell. Mr. Snell, please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Steve Snell. I am employed by the City of Eden Prairie as the City Assessor, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers Legislative Committee. The MAAO supports the statute changes in Article 4 that in five field, the ability to provide appraisals and testimony in tax court is critical to a fair and efficient judicial review of the property tax appeals. Assessors have been licensed by the State Board of Assessors since 1971, and private appraisers have been licensed by the Commerce Department since 1989. The assessors have been trained in both the mass appraisal techniques necessary to get the original assessments in place and in single property appraisal to allow them to do the appeals. And the duties for most assessors have included both the mass appraisals and appeals, both at the informal appeals, local board of appeal and equalization, county board appeals, and tax court. In fact, most assessors probably spend 40% of their time on appeals of some nature. The statute on prohibited activities by assessors was passed in 1993, and this legislation was supported by the MAAO and the State Board of Assessors, and the intent was to prevent moonlighting by assessors. The moonlighting that was occurring in a few places that was felt to be detrimental to both the property tax process and the appraisal process was an assessor being the assessor for the county or city, and then doing appraisals for another purpose at a different time during the year, and the inherent conflict of doing two different kinds of appraisals. In recent tax court appeals, the objection has been raised that assessors testifying is inappropriate and was upheld by the tax court. And this tax court rulings that assessors cannot prepare appraisals or testify in court has changed our procedures and processes that have worked for many decades. With the assessors involved in preparing tax court appraisals, it facilitates a less cumbersome process which often benefits the taxpayer. As tax court appeals are filed over a year after the original assessment's in place, a retrospective appraisal is necessary, so it's an after-the-fact review. And in most cases, the taxpayer or appellant has provided additional information that and the all the sales information that's available has now been thoroughly vetted, and we all know what's going on in hindsight, and it allows for the settlement of most cases based on a review of factual information at the lowest cost to both parties. In fact, for example, in Eden Prairie, we have 121 tax court appeals. Last year, we went to court on one. and that was the Eden Prairie Mall. All, you know, most appeals are settled or dismissed by the taxpayer when they also have a chance to see all the information about the property and the market. If the assessor is removed from the process, it will make the process more cumbersome and expensive for both the appellant and the local taxpayers. And we've occasionally hired an outside appraiser for a property that we may not necessarily have the necessary expertise. Example, in Eden Prairie, the Eden Prairie Mall, if it's a one-of-a-kind property, there's a handful of people around the country that are really experts on valuing those properties, so we hired some experts to represent us. But on a routine appraisal for tax court, most of the appraisals aren't houses. They're, most of the appeals are of commercial industrial properties, apartment buildings, income-producing properties. And a conservative estimate at $5,000 apiece, if we had to hire an appraiser for everyone, for Hennepin County would be $9 million annually. And Ms. Hahn-Cortez told me the last few appraisals we've had to hire have been more like $15,000 apiece. You know, it always depends on the availability of appraisers with the necessary expertise. But the to conclude, the MAO feels that the procedures that have been in place for decades have worked, and the unintended consequence of the moonlighting statute and the interpretation by the court has really encumbered the process to get all these appeals done in a timely process.
Thank you, Mr. Snell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Hahn-Cortez. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney, and for about the past 8 years, I've practiced primarily or predominantly in the property tax division and have been intimately involved in tax court matters with ad valorem appeals. A couple of things I just wanted to point out, and some of this is probably a little bit repetitive. The counties and the cities have licensed assessors as staff individuals who up until May and June of 2009 have without question been testifying and preparing appraisal reports for tax court. They've been qualified and accepted as expert witnesses, and their appraisal reports have been entered into evidence. The tax court judges always have and always will and do remain the final arbiter of who is a qualified expert and what weight they will put on any analysis that's found in the appraisal reports. The statutory proposal that is before you today is seeking to conform the language of the statute 270.41 subdivision 5, in particular, to past practice in light of the most recent court interpretation that assessors are prohibited from preparing appraisal reports and testifying. This most recent tax court decision, or two decisions, are not limited to preparing appraisal reports and testifying before the tax court. They, in the language of the decisions, are not limited in that respect. They apply to every part of any review analysis an assessor can has done in the past. Whether a taxpayer calls and says, can you please look at my value? I'd like to talk to you about it. They're prohibited from doing any kind of analysis. They're prohibited from doing any kind of assignment. And for every taxpayer that calls and every petition that is filed in tax court, there is some sort of analysis. There's some sort of a report that is generated by the assessor in order to be able to determine whether or not that assessment correctly, accurately reflects the market value of the property. So that piece and part that is clearly efficient and cost-effective and is an integral part of the assessment process and the review of the assessment is now removed from the assessor's abilities. The prohibition on that's being looked at right now are the prohibited activities. That statute, if you look at the legislative history, was enacted in 1993 was put in place because there were assessors, licensed assessors, who were also licensed real estate appraisers who were doing fixed fee appraisal reports they were being compensated for an entity other than the government, and it was outside of their scope of their business as doing the assessment, which is clearly a conflict of interest. And that is the only, that is, if you clearly look at the legislative history, that is the activity that was sought to be prohibited, and it should be. I mean, there is no doubt in anyone's mind. And it owes, that statute has been in place since 1993, and it wasn't until May and June of 2009 that there was any doubt as to what that statute meant. I just want to make a little analogy here. There's been some suggestion that it is fair for the government to have to pay for an outside appraiser because the taxpayer has to pay for an outside appraiser. An analogy to that would be if you're a criminal defendant and you have to hire an expert witness in your defense and you have to pay for that out of your dollar, out of your own pocket, that somehow that the government is not allowed to use their crime investigators, their accident reconstructionists, their gunshot residue experts who they have on staff and who are qualified expert individuals in their field to be able to use those individuals in a criminal proceeding, that the government would somehow not be able to do that. They'd have to go out and hire an expert somewhere else and pay for it outside of the salaries of the individuals that are on staff. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. It's not an efficient and effective way of using the resources that are available. And the whole, we want to preserve the taxpayers. We represent the assessor's offices and the county attorneys. We all represent the taxpayers. We're trying to preserve the taxpayers so that everyone is paying their fair share of taxes, and that if an individual is allowed to get an unfair, well, I shouldn't even say, if there is a reduction that's not warranted because the taxpayer says, well, I'm going to just, you know, hold you until the last possible minute and make you spend $20,000 for an appraisal report, and you're going to decide, well, I'm just going to get a reduction so I don't have to pay for that, so that the government doesn't have to pay for that. That puts an additional burden on the rest of the taxpayers. That's spread out through everyone. So just just a little background, for the pay 2007 in Hennepin County, there were about 1,000 petitions that were filed, and for 2008, there were 1,237 petitions. So in order for the county assessors and county attorneys to be able to negotiate and settle any of these cases, they would have to, under the current ruling, go out and hire an appraisal, a fee appraiser, get a report in order to be able to even begin the negotiation process.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on to that point, why can't the county negotiate a settlement before hiring an outside appraiser?
In order to be able to negotiate a settlement, you have to be able to do an analysis on the property in question. And in order to be able to do an analysis on the property, you'd have to be able to look at comparables. You'd have to be able to look at the value, come to a conclusion of value, which is part of the prohibited activities that the court found that an assessor cannot do.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think you're confusing the issue. The office has already assessed and assigned a value. So then the negotiations would take place between the assigned valuation and the constituent's position. There certainly can be negotiation at that point without a further analysis.
The assessment is generally done on a mass appraisal analysis. When someone comes in, a taxpayer comes in and says, I think that the assessed value is too high, then the assessor, it's not that they just say, well, it's, you know, it's right, you're, let me look at your information. They will take the taxpayer's information and they will look at what they have, but they will also do their own independent analysis, because when they set the assessment, they aren't doing an actual appraisal report on every property out there. It's impossible for them to do. They have many, many thousands of pieces of property. So they have to do an actual analysis on the individual property to go out and look at if it's sales comparables, to look at sales comparables that they feel are appropriate to that property. They have to look at the income, if it's an income-producing property, and ascertain whether there's an income approach that's appropriate. If it's a new property, look at the costs. It isn't just a matter of saying, the assessed value versus what the taxpayer is. There's a whole process that's involved with evaluating whether that assessment is accurate, and that requires an analysis and, if you will, a mini appraisal.
Mr. Chair, I think that makes the very good case why we should hold back and not do anything statutorily until the Supreme Court has explained the scope of their ruling and its application to the work that the counties do.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question about if the court ruling stands, what happens to the cases prior, before the new court ruling? Would that affect them back to 1993? If there were complaints prior to the court ruling, would you have like a bunch of people saying, I want to be reassessed?
I don't believe that that would be possible because there's a statutory deadline for filing appeals in that any cases that were already resolved and finalized, if they went to court, would not, there's no avenue, I think, for them to come back to question it.
Thank you, Ms. Cordes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Richard Hodsdon, H-O-D-S-D-O-N. I'm an assistant Washington County attorney. Among my assignments in Washington County, I've been involved in the property tax appeal area since 2003. As a matter of background, we handle between 120 to 160 property tax petitions a year in Washington County. Every lawyer says this. I'll try and be honest about it and be brief. I have 5 points to make, and I'll leave it at that. First, you heard a prior witness state that all three tax court judges have ruled on this particular matter that it's inappropriate for assessors to testify. That's not an accurate statement. That's been before three of the judges. The chief judge, Judge Perez, in fact, ruled just earlier this week that he would not rule on that issue because he's waiting for the legislature to give direction. And so I understand the concern about the legislature intervening into the judicial and tax court process, but in fact, the flip side is here. So I don't believe it's necessarily untimely or inappropriate for this body to act, particularly since tax court is a creature of statutory executive branch in the nature of administrative as opposed to judicial. See, we don't have the traditional separation of powers that you would normally have, which is why I think a couple of the senators perhaps would otherwise recommend deferral. So that's my first point. Second point, Senator Lemmer in earlier discussions, and I'm sorry he's not here, raised the issue, is this a competency issue of assessors versus appraisers? I want to assure the members of this committee that it is not. You've already heard testimony about the licensing and credentialing of assessors, and I think probably the best way to demonstrate their capabilities is in the real world. Since 2003, every tax court valuation case that's gone to trial in Washington County has been an appraiser in-house, not an outside hired person, an in-house Washington County appraiser testifying on behalf of the county against an outside appraiser as an expert witness for the taxpayer. In every single one of those cases, with one exception, the tax court weighed the credibility of the assessor versus this hired outside appraiser and raised the valuation above and beyond the assessed valuation, which should tell you that in the eyes of the tax court, credibility-wise, the assessors have better knowledge, information, and credibility than these outside appraisers in many of these cases. So the one case where that didn't happen is Shops of Woodbury, which is the case in which one of the three tax court judges prohibited the assessor, from testifying. Had our assessor been allowed to testify, she had a full-blown appraisal with expert testimony that, again, the assessed value, was undervalued, and the value should have gone up. So I think that gives you an indication in terms of competency. Third issue, fairness and cost. It will cost far more than the cost of 7 cases, as a prior witness indicated, if we have to go to outside appraisers. As a practical matter, we would have to hire 120 to 150 outside appraisers in Washington County alone for all these cases. You already heard the Assistant Hennepin County Attorney explain that process. The other reason we have to do that is we have no control over whether or not these cases go forward or get dismissed. Up to and including issuance of a verdict, the taxpayer at any time can dismiss this case. If we go out and hire an appraiser that shows that we have, in fact, under-assessed this property, We provide that taxpayer the appraisal. They can dismiss at any time. In other words, we have no right to stop that. If we've made a mistake in giving the taxpayer a low ball, we're stuck with it, and there's nothing that we've done about that. If we're talking about really leveling the playing field, then the taxpayers should be stuck in the same boat as the counties are, and right now they're not. They have a tactical advantage, so I don't believe that there's a fairness issue there. We would spend a huge amount of money just trying to do what's required. I also point out from a taxpayer standpoint, in many areas, for expert witnesses, we are a loser-pay situation. The prior witness that talked about spending $12,000 or $13,000 in expert witness costs, right now, if we have to go out and hire an independent witness, in that particular case, that taxpayer lost. He did not get a reduction in valuation. That means the courts can assess an additional $12,000 or $13,000. The counties added on expert witness costs now, and the taxpayer has to pay that. There is that old saying, be careful what you wish for, you might get it, and I'm wondering if the taxpayers really necessarily have thought that through. They're getting a break right now by having assessors testify rather than having the counties go out and hire outside guns. And believe me, assessors do testify. This is not a case where only outside appraisers are done. We don't use outside appraisers in Washington County. All of our cases since the whole time I've handled have used in-house. Then my fourth point is that I understand that the state tax section of the State Bar Association does not support and, in fact, opposes this change. And to the extent you want to consider their perspectives, let me simply suggest many of us in the public sector are also members of that association. I have found not a single one of my colleagues that was even asked to provide input or thought as to whether or not what our views on this. In other words, the tax section division of the State Bar Association simply is not speaking for a big chunk of its members. One has to ask why, and I'll leave that rhetorical question hanging there. But please, I would encourage to the fact that a special interest group within the State Bar Association thinks that this proposal that you're advancing is a bad idea. That's not by any way, shape, or form the universal view of we public sector lawyers.
Thank you. To the employees of the department, it doesn't appear we're going to get to the second bill today or to the tax incident study, so they probably can find their way back to do something more productive than sit here and watch us talk about assessors. And I believe we're going to meet tomorrow 9 o'clock, and we'll pick up the second bill and the tax incidents. Was it tax incidents or tax expenditure report? Who is here from the State Bar? We're going to hear from them, and then we're going to conclude for today.
No, we haven't.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Robert Stewart. I'm the chair of the Minnesota State Bar Association Tax Law Section, and I'm here to testify on behalf of the Tax Law Section. To my left is Larry Martin. He's a former assessor, current appraiser, and he's going to assist me with some technical questions in case there are. The Tax Law Section of the Minnesota State Bar Association opposes the provisions in Senate File 2701, which allow assessors to provide expert testimony in tax court cases if they're not a licensed appraiser. The reason for our opposition is that this legislation effectively overrides a few recent tax court cases. It represents a significant change in the law, and it inappropriately overrides certain rules of evidence. Bottom line is that we feel that it's unfair that the taxpayers are held to a different standard than the counties are. In this regard, the tax court has recently, in prior decisions, consistently held that the taxpayer must hire an appraiser, a licensed appraiser. They've denied expert testimony for real estate attorneys, for brokers, for investors, for managers. They've all been prevented from testifying as experts. So there is a difference between an assessor and an appraiser. There's different licensing standards, different education standards. They're not the same. There's a reason why there's a different licensing requirement for appraisers. Appraisers are required to have a bachelor's degree and quite a bit more education and training before they can become a licensed appraiser. Assessors, they may have that much, but it's not a requirement. So there's definitely some differences. Also, there's something called the Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practice. Appraisers are required to file all of their appraisals consistent with that. Assessors are not. What our view, at least, is that this disproportionately affects the smaller taxpayers, and those are the taxpayers that, you know, have to go out and hire an appraiser where, if there's enough money involved, it's likely the county will also hire an outside appraiser. And situations where there isn't enough, it really puts the taxpayer at a disadvantage, you know, cost-wise. I will also, before I turn it over for questions, I'll at least mention, how this was brought up in the tax section. We have a legislative initiative committee that is open up to all members of the tax section. We put out emails to everybody. If you want input, you want to, you know, participate in the committee and bring forward any legislative ideas, we're happy to listen to them. The committee met on several occasions and provided its recommendations to the tax council, who meets once a month. There was discussions on this. The vote was unanimous to oppose this legislation. So it went through all the proper procedures, and then it went through the State Bar Association as well. Obviously, there are probably members of our section that might not agree with everything we do, but we do have a procedure in place, and this is the official position of the tax law section, is to oppose this bill.
Mr. Stewart, thank you. Mr. Martin.
Thank you, Chair, Senators. My name is Larry Martin. As Mr. Stewart stated in his testimony, I've been asked here to come today to answer any technical issues with respect to the bill. My background, Mr. Stewart referenced that I am a licensed appraiser, but I'm also an attorney, and I do practice in the area of property tax appeals. The one technical issue that I would like to address is the idea or notion of a fiscal impact. By not acting on this legislation, by not passing the legislation, I think the message that some people want you to hear is that there's a massive financial or fiscal impact, and I don't think that's true. I think it's hard to see that as being true, and to understand it, you have to have an understanding of how the tax court manages its caseload. For example, once a case is filed, the matter doesn't go to trial for maybe a year to 2 years, and it's only after the tax court has set the case for trial a couple of times and has given the party an opportunity to negotiate to resolve the matter without going through exorbitant expenses related to preparing for trial and especially the high cost of an appraisal. And so strategically, the court has set it up so people don't have that expense until, all negotiation efforts have been exhausted. And so that's why when you see Mr. Bedore, I think, testify that there aren't that many cases that go to trial, and I did a count, too, just to check to make sure my facts would be accurate. I think, last year, during calendar year number 2009, there were 8 valuation cases that actually went to trial that the court reported on. And of those 8, I think there were 5 that assessors, or I'm going to just call it the government, relied upon outside appraisers. The previous year, the number was more like, I think it was 12 the previous year, calendar year 2008. And again, I think the number, again, was 5 that they relied upon staff appraisers. And so in terms of raw numbers, it's small. One of the issues that they're raising is, well, maybe to prepare for negotiations, we have to have full-blown appraisals done if you don't act on this legislation. And there's nothing under current law that says that that's necessary. I mean, to do an assessment, to do an analysis, to prepare for negotiations, there's nothing under current law that requires them to do that. Quite frankly, it'd be like saying that everybody has to have an appraisal license to negotiate to buy a piece of property. That's simply not true. You don't have to have an appraisal done for negotiations, and I don't think anybody expects that. And so I'd like to suggest that that's a bit of a stretch. Other than that, I think Mr. Stewart has covered some of the technical issues with respect to the difference in licenses. I know that Senator Scheid asked a question earlier concerned about the difference between assessors and appraisers. As an appraiser, I would like to highlight that there is a difference. Assessors have licenses to conduct assessments, mass appraisals, deal with mass appraisal issues, to advocate for their assessment if it's being challenged, and to negotiate with people, calculate some numbers to come to some sort of reasonable resolution. But the difference is that the real estate appraiser, the licensed appraiser, has to follow the Department of Commerce's rules, including what's referred to as USPAP, the Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practice. And just to give you a short note on that, and I know I shouldn't be taking too long, Chair, the purpose of that rule, those laws, the USPAP laws, is to prohibit appraisers from conducting misleading appraisals. And it's an important standard. It's kind of like, well, if you do conduct a misleading appraisal, that appraisal can be challenged, can be reported to the Department of Commerce, and you're subject to prosecution for doing so. And from an even playing field perspective, it's more, well, let's all follow the same rules when we're classifying something as an appraisal. Let's all follow the same USPAP rules when we're certifying to those. Let's all follow the same rules when we're developing those appraisals, and let's all follow the same rules when we're giving it to a judicial body to say, this is what the report means. And, by the way, I'm certifying that I've complied with these rules, and so I'm credible. Senators, those are the technical issues I wanted to address. I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Well, either one of you, I think, can try to answer this, but it does appear to me that and from everybody I've talked to, the legislative intent of that moonlighting provision was not to prevent assessors from testifying. The legislative intent was, when it was passed, to stop them from moonlighting. Now, the court has taken a broader interpretation, but it seems like the legislative intent was pretty clear. So, I mean, really, the way I view this is I think the legislature, by the court, is just being asked to go back and revisit what was the intent. And I think that's what the department is trying to bring here. Now, is there some middle ground here that might somehow bring a little more balance, I think might be a reasonable question to ask. Do you have any suggestion on what some middle ground might be?
I can speak from, again, a technical perspective, Chairman, and I can't speak for the MSBA. But when you take a look at what's before the committee, there are three different proposals, and there's only one that they'd like to change that has to deal with the prohibition, and that's the one I'm just going to call it the moonlighting section, Chair. And I think it's fair to say that back in 1993, and my experience in assessing and appraising does go back beyond that. I suppose it's apparent by the way I look. At that time, moonlighting was a concern, but it's also true that it's always been a concern that if there is an appraisal out there conducted by an assessor that's inconsistent with the valuation that they've actually placed on the books for tax purposes, it presents an unexplainable conflict, not only, in terms of what the assessor is doing at night, but also in terms of how well a job the assessor is doing in the daytime. It's like having two sets of books. What you say it's worth on the market and what you say it's worth for tax purposes, and that's an unreconcilable conflict. It just so happens that the ugliest time it comes up is when you're moonlighting. I don't know that that's such a big issue in today's world, because I think it's fair to say that for the most part, people that work on these issues don't expect the assessment to always equal the real market value if the property was put on the market. There's errors that are going to be made. Everybody looks at it as a mass appraisal system. People recognize that it takes time for the assessors to catch up. Those are all, you know, elements of the process that can't be avoided. And so whether or not that prohibition section can be worked on, it seems to me that that's a place to focus. Changing the rules of evidence without, that seems to me it would be a problem. And then just changing the standards of, can an assessor already, automatically say, well, I'm also a licensed appraiser. I'm also, without having some sort of certification that I'm qualified to do uniform USPAP qualifying appraisals. That seems to me to be a problem. But having said that, it seems to me that there is some interpretation that can make everybody happy, but it probably takes more.
So
debate.
Is there a level of expertise that assessors, a standard we might be able to set for assessors that would satisfy the bar that the assessors do have the adequate skills that they need? Rather than just prohibit them, is there some required standard we could put in place that would say, well, no, that assessor is qualified?
Yeah, and I can speak a little bit to that. We didn't get into a discussion at the bar on alternative legislation like that. So I guess I'd have to speak just personally on my own rather than as the bar. But I do think that the concerns about being able to negotiate or something like that could certainly. That sounds reasonable, at least from my personal perspective, to allow negotiations and everything else. But when it comes to expert testimony in tax court, if taxpayers aren't going to be able to have a real estate attorney that's very knowledgeable in the area testify as an expert because they're not an appraiser, it seems inconsistent to say, well, somebody else that's not an appraiser can testify on behalf of the counties. So it seems like if we're going to open up the door to non-appraisers, I mean, the door should be open then. It shouldn't be just the counties that get to use somebody that's not an assessor, appraiser, I'm sorry.
But that's been the practice.
Well, I don't think it's been challenged before recently. The fact that it was the practice before is I think no taxpayers had challenged it. It wasn't as if the tax court had changed its mind. It was just that, nobody had challenged this specific provision in the past.
But who would have ever presumed that the assessors couldn't sit down and negotiate with the taxpayer? Who would have ever presumed we would? Apparently, there's some interpretation that that's where the court case sets the bar.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody would would be the case. And apparently, there are assessors feel that that's where they're at today.
And like I said, I from my personal standpoint, I think that should be allowed. That they should be allowed to negotiate and everything else. It's just when you get to the threshold of tax court testimony, I think it's a different. You're in a different field then, different ballpark. You're dealing with, saying that they're an expert on this, and the court is relying on them to come up with their valuation. It's not just negotiations.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, to this point about the process that the assessor goes through and he's going to do the negotiations. The taxpayer comes in with his complaint, and so the assessor sits down and does his research to come up with what he thinks the value is, and then he starts the negotiations. And if we don't make this change, then at some point somebody else is going to step in and do their evaluation and take that to court. That seems like kind of a disconnect that you're going to have a real problem in the process if we don't figure out a way to keep that information accurate and the same through the negotiations and then into court. And so I think you got a little issue going here that if you're going to have the assessor do his process and take it partway and then somebody else will step in and go to court on it. I think that's a problem. So, if we're going to do more work on this. I think that has to be addressed.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a question maybe the assessors can answer. I am sure that assessors have some professional standards to which they're held. So I think there's a suggestion that there's not a standard. I'm also reflecting on debates that we had around Highway 52 and the competing appraisals, you know, when folks were having their property acquired for the expansion of that facility down in Rochester. And those were competing appraisals from appraisers. So I think there's also a suggestion somehow that a given appraiser's analysis is the gold standard and that they can be wildly divergent. So I think we just need to keep in mind a couple of these factors, a couple of these dynamics.
Mr. Hagan, any comment as to the credibility of assessors or their educational attainment? Or
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibbles, I would certainly like to weigh in on this. There's so many issues I'd like to talk to. It's hard to focus my attention, but certainly assessors are bound by ethical standards. We've got an ethics. The legislature requires assessors to take an ethics course once every licensing period to maintain licensure. I have to congratulate Mr. Martin for an extremely creative approach to the prohibited activities, and I commend him. I think it's interesting. Nobody had ever challenged the prohibited activities provision before. It was brought to the legislature as part of a Department of Revenue policy bill for the sole purpose of prohibiting moonlighting. And moonlighting was, I think, as Mr. Sinnell spoke to, the basic conflict with what happens when an assessor using mass appraisal values a property and then working as a moonlighter or as a fee appraiser comes up with a different value. And that's very easy. That's very easy to happen. It's very easy to explain. I'm not sure how successful this is going to be. I hope it doesn't end up like the gentleman that tried to break the egg a year or so ago. But I was lying in bed this morning thinking about this very issue and wondering about an analogy that might be synonymous to appraisers and assessors. And it worked for me in the early hours of the morning, so I'm not at all sure it'll work for you, but I certainly hope it does. I would think you could liken a mass appraisal done by an assessor to, if you took your car to an assessor and asked them to wash it, they would drive it through the car wash. At the end of the day, you'd have a clean car. An appraisal is much more specific than that. You'd be taking it to a specific detailing service, and they'd spend half a day washing the car and get to know the car better than the assessor driving it through the car wash, which does result in a clean car. But when you wash the car and detail it by hand, you become more aware of the quality of the car, the condition of the car, any defects the car might have. The same is true with an assessor. When you make broad brush determinations based on a mass appraisal, you go through and make a lot of generalizations about the quality of the property, conditions of the property, income, expense, vacancy, all those different components. If the property owner challenges the assessment, as they certainly have every right to do, they can do it at the local board, the county board, they have ample opportunities to challenge it, or going directly to the assessor to challenge it, the assessor should, in my estimation, is well served, and it's very appropriate to take a look at the property and make a determination, have I made some generalizations that aren't appropriate? Is the condition of the property worse than I had assumed, or better than I had assumed, or whatever it is, on those assumptions? Oftentimes, the result of that review appraisal is the property value might go down. It never ends up in court. The appraiser, looking at it more specifically, looking at it with sales comparables of 3 to 5 sales comparisons for that particular property, it very easily could go down. The assessor could, on the other hand, look at it in the course of their appraisal and say, you know, I was not aware of different conditions or components or how much income the property was getting, and the value could go up. And then they could continue on the court. As you've heard previous testimony to today, if the assessor doing an appraisal on that property, which is a more specific look at the property, identifies a higher value, they would proceed on to court. But it's up to the petitioner at any time. They can drop the court proceedings, or they could just discontinue it if they disagree with the value, or if the higher value is problematic to them, and they would revert back to the assessed value.
So, Mr. Hagan, does the court decision prohibit the assessor from doing more detailed work on the appraisal in the negotiation process?
Mr. Chairman, in my opinion, it does not. In my opinion, the prohibition of activity was, as I said, and I tried to say, and I'm not sure I finished it, the real basic conflict in is that if an assessor values a property at a certain value amount, and then they look at it as an appraisal, and they come up with a different value amount, particularly a lower value amount, it would have the appearance to the property owners, and to the, not so much the property owners, but the rest of the taxpayers, is if you hire the county assessor, and they do an appraisal on the property, and the value goes down, and you exchange money for the cost of the appraisal, there is a pretty strong appearance that there's an impropriety there, that the value was reduced in exchange for money. Conversely, if the assessor who has already established a market value goes and establishes an appraisal value, one and the same, the assessor and the appraiser are both looking for the same market value, the assessor looks at more specific data and spends more time on it. If the value goes up, then wouldn't it be incumbent on the assessor, who's charged with developing market values, to increase the value to reflect the appraisal amount? And this is going to be problematic for property owners, too. When you hire an appraisal to get for whatever purpose, and the assessor raises your value as a result, that's problematic. That is why the department brought the prohibition legislation, the request, to the legislature in 1993 to prevent that obviously ethical conflict on the part of the assessor.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to renew my motion when we're done with the testimony.
Senator Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hagan, isn't it true that the statute specifically allows assessors to not have to be licensed as appraisers?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moore, that's exactly correct in my opinion.
And isn't it true, Mr. Hagan, that the statute also says that assessors, in the performance of their duties to their municipalities, are allowed to perform appraisal-type duties, and it is because of that allowance that we explicitly exempt them from having to have an appraisal license?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that is correct, in my opinion.
So, Mr. Chair, I don't know why we're spending so much time in this conversation. I think that there were the two witnesses said that there are three issues. I think one issue is the moonlighting issue. As a matter of public policy, if we agree that we don't want our assessors to be moonlighting, then we just make sure that the language in the statute is explicit about that, because that has always been the intent. As a matter of public policy, and the statute says that we have been explicit and intentional about not requiring our assessors to be licensed appraisers, but they can still act in that capacity. The statute explicitly says that. Then I don't know why we're arguing about that. We should just clarify the language to make sure that that's what it says, because that's been the intention all along. And the last issue is whether or not we want to prohibit assessors from testifying in court. And I think that's the other public policy argument that we should talk about. And as far as I'm concerned, that may be the only issue that's left for us to talk about. And my sense is, I mean, if this were in the Judiciary Committee, I would say, you know what? Let them at it, and then let the judges decide who has the credibility to testify after they've been qualified, whether they're a licensed appraiser or an assessor. I mean, as a matter of public policy, we explicitly have exempted assessors from having to be licensed appraisers. But now we're saying that they then can't testify on behalf of the municipality when we have said that they don't have to be licensed appraisers?
Well, Senator Moore, I don't think we're saying they can't testify. I think a court decision said that. And why it's back here.
Well, Mr. Chair, that provision says that they don't have to be licensed appraisers in order to serve as employees of the county and act as an assessor. I mean, I think you could talk about the intent about that all day. It doesn't say specifically that they can testify as an appraiser even though they don't have a license. That doesn't say that.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Moore.
It also doesn't say that they can't testify.
Well, Mr. Chair, the court did say that.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Moore.
We're the legislature.
True.
Senator Pokemon, you want to get in this?
Well, all I know is that Senator Ortman's a Hennepin County employee, and Senator Moa is the chair of the Judiciary Committee. Why don't we take it over to Judiciary and let them hack around a while, and then Senator Ortman can go talk to her budget people in Hennepin County and decide what's the smartest thing to do for the taxpayer.
Well, there does seem to be an issue that the fact that the taxpayer that files the appeal, if the county goes out, the assessor goes out and gets a private assessment, and it's higher, then the appellant can just walk away. And it seems to me maybe the appellant then should automatically get the higher assessment. Or the county should be able to pursue the higher assessment. The case should still be open. Senator Hartman, shouldn't the case still be open?
Mr. Chair, I didn't follow your logic. I'm sorry.
Well, it seems like if you appeal your value and the county, and we require the county then to go out and get a private appraisal, that if the private appraisal comes in higher, the appellant has the authority to then drop their appeal. Why? Why shouldn't we then take it to the next level and raise the valuation? But we don't currently. So maybe that's part of the discussion if we continue down this road, that sure. Maybe you run some risk in going through an appeal that your value could actually go up, because currently you don't run a risk of that. Because if it looks like it's going to go up, you just can drop your appeal. Mr. Stewart, is that accurate?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would say that, you know, that there is a chance of it going up, and if it goes to decision. I mean, my understanding is you can drop it prior to trial. But, you know, once it goes to decision, I mean, you could end up in a situation where it does go up. And, you know, it just because an appraisal comes in, one comes in higher and one comes in lower than the assessed value, that, you know, that might be very typical. And, you know, to allow the taxpayer to drop it probably would be an efficient use of judicial resources as well.
But it might be in the county's best interest at that point, if it looks like they've made a mistake, to actually take it to court. And they don't have an opportunity to do that because the case has been the appeal's been dropped.
Mm-hmm. One issue I would raise is I think the testimony earlier was that up until verdict, the petitioner, the property owner, could drop the appeal. That's not my understanding. My understanding was to the beginning of trial, and mm-hmm. So once the trial begins, up until that point, the property owner can dismiss it.
Senator Pogomar.
Bar Association. This is an advocacy proceeding. Everybody has their expert. One side has one. Another side has one. There's not a neutral party here. So we can either run up the costs and continue an adversary proceeding, or why don't we set up a system that says both parties have to agree to the same appraiser on the front end and then live with it. Let's see if everybody thinks that's a good idea.
Senator, I think that's creative. I think
I'm a liberal, it might be common sense.
With costs, court costs, and all of that, I think, you know, everybody's looking towards alternative dispute resolutions in every level of litigation. Mediation has become a significant factor in resolving condemnation disputes. Senator Dibble had referenced the Highway 52 project down in Rochester and some of the appraisal issues that arose out of that. And it is true that that was a problem project. One of the reasons that it was, and well, one of the laws that has been enacted to bring impartiality to it is that, you know, people that are out buying right-of-way cannot actually appraise the right-of-way. You can't be the negotiator and the appraiser. And so I think that gets to the question that Senator Dibble had brought up. But Senator Pogomiller, the ideas or notions of alternative dispute resolution are good ones. And I think that what you're getting at, Senator, is that if you have somebody neutral that you both have to live with, at least it's somebody that one person's a licensed appraiser that has to follow USPAP. Mr. Hagen had testified that the assessors do have to follow ethical standards, and that's true, but those misleading laws that I talked about aren't part of those standards that they subscribe to. Again, as an appraiser, I raise that as a significant difference.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Pogomar.
Just one other observation. It just seems to defy common sense that someone who's been hired by the citizens to assess everybody's property is not an expert on assessing. I just sit there and I think, gosh, how does that work? So we can't hear from them in a court case? The court gets to decide whether they believe that or not, don't they?
Senator, I think this is true. I'm sorry, Chair. Chairman, Senator Pogomiller, the assessors are allowed to testify. The cases didn't say that they couldn't testify, but their testimony is limited to the assessment, that the work that they're licensed to do. The area when they stray into what the courts referred to as lay testimony is when they want to testify as like a licensed appraiser. And so that's where the court is drawing the distinction. And so they are expert assessors, not necessarily expert at doing single property use PAP compliant appraisals, which is a high level of licensure.
Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, and to the witness, I guess I have to say that, I mean, I haven't read the case, and I don't, you know, so I don't have the context that you have, but that's just wrong. I mean, it's contrary to what the statutes say. I mean, the statute explicitly says that assessors, in the performance of their jobs for the local units of government in their jurisdiction, are, for all intended purposes, appraisers for the local unit of government. And so if in the statute, we are in essence saying, if the assessors are acting in their capacity as assessors and employees for the jurisdiction that they represent and doing that in the capacity of their job, for all intended purposes, they are appraisers. So I guess I don't understand the argument that you're making, because that's not what the statutes say.
The one of the issues that did come up in that case, I'm sorry,
Mr. Chair, Martin,
Senator Moore, nowhere in the legislation, nowhere in the statutes will you see language that says that assessors, as part of their duties, can do single property use PAP compliant appraisals. I think that gets back to Senator Scheid's question earlier, is that there is a distinguish. I think it's fair to distinguish assessing from appraising from that perspective. People like to use the terms synonymously, interchangeably, but what I'm suggesting is that it's unfair to do that. They are two different activities.
Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, I want to be respectful. But let me just say that under current law, in the bill, line 1.24 to line 1.26, the language says this prohibition must not be construed to prohibit an individual from carrying out any duties required for the proper assessment of property for property tax purposes. And if you read this along with the explicit exemption of assessors from having to be a licensed appraiser, then I don't know how it could get sliced to say that they somehow have to be explicitly allowed to be appraisers. We could change the language to be more clear, if clarity is the issue. But I think that the if you read the statutes, it certainly is clear that we intend for assessors to be able to, in the carrying out of their duties, for their municipalities to be able to act as appraisers.
Might I respond?
Go ahead.
Lisa Hahn-Cortis again. Just with respect to a couple of issues, in response to the fact that there is no specific duty, which is where the court did hang its hat, our understanding of the statute is exactly as you have stated it was, Senator Moore. The court went to looking at the specific duties for assessors and said, because there's not a specific duty spelled out in the statutes that says that an assessor can do a single
do an appraisal report for a property in their jurisdiction on behalf of the government. As part of the assessment process for property for property tax purposes, that somehow they're not allowed to do it. And I would point out that part of the arguments were made that that assessors are limited to only doing mass appraisal. Nowhere in any duty or any statutory provision anywhere does it say that assessors can or must do mass appraisals. So the court looked at looked really narrowly at what the duties are and said that the assessors are only allowed to do what duties are specified in statute. And since there wasn't a specific provision that said that assessors can't duties for the proper assessment of property for property tax purposes included doing appraisals, appraisal reports, assignments and analyses for the purpose of testifying before the court as an expert witness, that was where the court hung its hat. And which is why the language specifically to clarify that make it clear that the activities being sought to be added here are considered part of the proper assessment for property tax purposes, the duties of the assessor is being sought to be put into that language.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Who has the burden of proof? The assessment is the core evidence in the case, right? The plaintiff says, I disagree with this assessment. It gets brought into court. The assessor can discuss and defend the assessment, but then is it not the case that the plaintiff or the taxpayer has the burden of proving then that the assessment is not appropriate for given all the circumstances? So then what happens in these proceedings is then the plaintiff has to bring forward an expert witness, an appraiser, to say, to contradict the assessment or to challenge the assessment. And then the county or the assessor would then, under current law, be able to come in, switch hats from defending and explaining the assessment and say, okay, now I'm an appraiser and I'm an expert, even though I'm not an appraiser, and say, let's look back again at my assessment. It really was, on an expert level, an appropriate valuation. So you got the same guy testifying in two different roles in the same proceeding, or his colleague or whatever, but you've got that. The burden of proof is the plaintiff's, and now you've got the same guy being both the evidentiary witness and also the expert witness, and that's where it's problematic. Is that? I mean, I've never tried a case in tax court, but that's my understanding of what's happening here, right?
Chairman, Senator Ortman, that is correct.
Madam Chair,
Senator Pogue,
Mr. Chairman, sorry. Let's then take assessors out of a neutral position. You know. Let's assume they are out and they're not somewhat neutral because, you know, they're just trying to do their job. Then I would suggest if we don't fix this, what the counties ought to do is find some professional expert witnesses that can be ready and prepared to testify when you need them about how your assessments are way too low. And then we can run up court costs and we can have a little struggle about that for a while. I mean, this is a procedure where a taxpayer is hiring somebody. Do you think a taxpayer who is not happy with what the county did is going to bring in an appraiser who agrees with the county? I bet you they won't. I bet you they'll bring in an expert who disagrees with the county and says it should be a lot lower. So if the counties are put in the position of, well, all right, if that's the game we're in here, then let's find some people who think we're way too conservative on our assessments and can really run that up there. And then we can all meet in the middle again. I mean, it just, this notion that somehow these county employees, now, I heard the testimony about why did it take 3 or 5 days. Yeah, I sit there and I kind of go, gee, that seemed a little odd that it should take that long, but that's a different issue than the one we're talking about now. If there are county, if they're dragging out court cases just to put a taxpayer in a position where you're going to run up the tab so they can't afford to be there, that's outrageous. I absolutely, if that is what happened, I don't know if it did. That's outrageous. And Mr. Bedore, I would love to work on legislation to fix that. But to somehow say that we shouldn't try to allow county assessors to do their job. I don't get that. I don't. It just seems like they're good enough to assess my house, but they're not good enough to tell a court that that's what the assessment is. I don't get that.
Senator Ortman, I agree with Senator Pogelmiller.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's the court that said it. It was the court that said we should not have assessors in these dual positions. It's not that there isn't faith in the assessors. It's that we're putting them in a very difficult position. How do they say one time that their assessment is perfectly appropriate and we put it on the a statement to the property taxpayer, and then we're going to ask them to serve as an expert as well and go back over their own assessment or their office's assessment and then think that they're going to be independent in doing that? That puts them in a terrible position.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogelmiller.
Would it make sense that an assessor would defend what they did in their job? To me, that makes sense.
Senator.
And I thought the explanation that what they do is they go in site-specific then and say, okay, on a specific parcel, did we misjudge? Should we, now that we look at it closer, what didn't we see on the overall assessment? Which, to me, seems logical.
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say that it's not the court that has said this. It is the court has said that this is what the legislature said. The court is interpreting the law. The court has said, well, we read the law, and this is what we think the legislature said. And it's up to the legislature to say, well, no, not really. This is what we meant. So court, we're sorry we weren't clear. First time around, we'll clarify what we meant to say.
Well,
so
Senator
courts
DeBlatt.
Don't make law. I mean, I certainly hope they don't make law. That's certainly the subject of a lot of debate and discussion on other subjects around here.
It does seem to me, Senator Dibble, that the provision the department brought us is to clarify what the legislative intent was in 1993 when that provision was passed. And that has been the practice from 1993 until this recent court decision and tax court decision in, was it in 09?
The decisions, I believe, was the most recent one was, might have been 09 or just recently in January of 10. Yeah. It's very recent. The cases were in May and June of 2009.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to add a couple
Mr.
more
Stewart.
Things if possible. I think that's right that, that this provision hadn't been challenged since it was enacted in 93. It just recently was. But, like I had said before, it wasn't as if the tax court took one position before and now is changing its mind. I think the tax court has uniformly interpreted this provision this way. It just has never been brought up to their attention before, and it's never been argued. As far as the differences, I think Senator Pogelmiller talked about between an assessor. I mean, assessors clearly have a job to do. They assess properties, use mass assessments to do that. They may use property-specific appraisals to help them with their assessments and do that, and they come up with an assessment. That's their job. Now, the question is their job also to change and author an appraisal report and testify in tax court as an expert defending that assessment, or is their job just to do the assessment? I mean, what is the job of an assessor in assessing the properties? Does it go?
Mr. Stewart, I think the question is, does the assessor have the right to go to court and defend his work?
Mr. Chair, as an expert, not just defend his work as being an assessor, but as an appraiser.
But the court is going to put weight to his testimony. The court ultimately makes that decision.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right?
Yeah. Yes, it does, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogelman.
Does the court know the difference between an appraiser and an assessor, or does the court not know?
Mr. Chair,
Martin.
Mr. Pogelmiller, I think it's fair to say that the court, in my experience, does recognize the difference and that there is an issue.
Mr. Chair, I would say that we appoint and confirm them, do we not, here in this committee? Maybe that's a question we should ask in the future. It's the difference between an assessor and an appraiser and see if they do know. I mean, I have to believe that they know, Senator.
Seems like they know the difference.
They must know the difference, and that's why it is powerful when a court says we shouldn't allow them in our court to serve in two capacities as a fact witness and also as an expert witness.
Ms. Cordes?
Address that. Thank you. The court in these cases have never said that the – I mean, to address your issue about whether the court says they're a fact witness and they can't be an expert witness, when these cases go to trial, the assessor in its testimony is only testifying as an expert witness. The assessment is prima facie valid. There's no discussion of the assessment. There's no evidentiary questions. Nothing is even chatted or talked about or discussed with respect to the assessment. So it's not as if they're coming in and saying, here's my assessment, and I'm going to talk about how I came to that assessment.
Well, Mr. Chair, with due respect, though, that the evidence, the assessment, is their testimony. It is their fact. Yes, it's like a crime lab report or something else. That the assessment is considered by the court.
With all respect, when a case goes to trial, unless the assessor or the county is just not putting in any other evidence, that assessment is not, there isn't any testimony with respect to that thing. The only time that assessment comes into, perhaps it comes into play, is when the court determines that the petitioner, the taxpayer, has failed to meet their burden of proof, and that there isn't any evidence on the other side. They can default to that assessment as the value for the property. But I'm not sure I understand where you're coming from.
Senator Pogemiller.
Senator Hartman, under your logic, should police officers not testify in court then when they make an arrest? Because they're enforcing the law, but in some fashion they're not the expert on what just took place? I'm just missing the logic here. I understand that they don't get to testify on whether the breathalyzer actually works, but here they're testifying on the value of the property, which is the essence of their job. That's what they do for a living.
Right.
Here's what this piece of property is worth. And that's what they're testifying on. They're not testifying on whether the computer that they use to do the calculation actually works, which is what a breathalyzer expert would do. Here they're testifying on the essence of their job. This is what I do for a living.
Right. Mr. Chair, the assessor comes in, Senator Pogemiller, and says, here's my assessment, or it's prima facie evidence of the value of the property. And then the court engages in a discussion about whether that assessment is appropriate for that piece of property. And then the court entertains expert testimony regarding that. And the taxpayer hires the expert, but the assessor doesn't have to, and the county doesn't have to. It's that same testimony.
Senator Hartman, why would you force the county to pay twice if they don't choose to? Now, they sometimes choose to, apparently, for I'm not sure totally why, but there must be a reason why they hire a second person. But in many cases, it appears they're willing to go with the less expensive method of saying, well, here's our expert against your expert. And that seems less expensive for a taxpayer. Again, I'm not arguing. If somehow if the Hennepin County Attorney's Office and the Washington County Attorney's Office are dragging these lawsuits out, as Mr. Bedore feels, that's a separate issue, and you shouldn't be doing that. But on the issue of can an assessor tell us what the value of the property is, it just seems so obvious. That's what they do for a living. They might be wrong. And that's why the taxpayer has somebody in there to say they're wrong. Who's getting paid more probably than the assessor. But okay, so be it.
Senator Pogemiller, the taxpayer has the authority in law to request a local impact note on a piece of legislation. What I wonder is this is kind of the reverse, I think. Is I wonder if the Department of Finance would tell us if we didn't do this. Oh, I'm told Representative Lencheski has a request pending, but maybe we should find out from the Department of Finance, if we don't do this, what is the cost to local government? I mean, I that might be helpful information for us.
Senator Hartman could get that information for Hennepin County for us when she goes back on her budget job over there.
So we'll check.
Ask your colleagues over there.
Make a decision, Senator Ortman, whether this is a good idea or not, I think it would be helpful for us to know if there is a cost to counties as a result of us not doing this. I think we're going to make this decision whether the department, we should do this. We should know a little bit more information, probably. Does that seem reasonable, Senator Ortman?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Senator Moy.
Before we vote on Senator Ortman's motion, I guess I'd like to know what your thinking is in terms of this is going to go.
I think if we take it out of the bill, it's going to be very hard for us to keep people engaged about a discussion if there's something we need to do here. I think if we leave it in, people will have more of an interest in kind of staying engaged in the process here and see if there's something that makes sense.
So, Mr. Chair, then are you going to send the bill to Judiciary?
If the Chair would like it, or if the Chair would just like those provisions. Does Judiciary hear issues relative to tax court that's outside of the judicial branch? If you'd like to, you certainly are welcome to.
I think tax court is part of the jurisdiction, and the witness issue is something that we should look at. I'm just asking the question because I'm not asking for more work, Mr. Chair. I am willing to vote for Senator Ortman's amendment to take it out of the bill. But if you think that it's important and you want to keep it in, I mean, we could take it out of the bill. Maybe these provisions could be jacketed, and we could review them in the Judiciary Committee. When we're done, we can send them back to you. If you want to leave it in, it's up to you.
Senator Moy, why don't we leave it in, and we will send you a letter with the language and ask you to take a look at it. Could we do it that way?
I don't know. I
mean, Chairman, it sounds to me like she was going to vote for Senator Ortman's amendment so she didn't have to do the work in her own committee. That's what it sounded like to me.
Well, Mr. Chair, if you're asking that I withdraw my motion, I'd like to know what are your intentions with the bill then. If you're planning to send it out of here, or are you planning to lay it on the table?
Planning on laying it over.
Mr. Chair, then I would withdraw my motion.
And I think if the department could maybe figure out who the stakeholders are, and I will I'll see if I can get an opinion from the Department of Finance as to if there is a local impact note to this. And let's see if there is, maybe if we need all three sections or not. Maybe we don't need all three. If there's a little better solution than maybe what we currently have. But I think until we know what the potential cost is, I mean, I'm not interested in creating a whole other line of work for a profession by not doing anything here. Senator Ortman, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd move to lay the bill on the table then.
Senator Ortman moves to lay, what's the bill number? Senate File 2701 on the table for the committee's future consideration. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. Members, we're going to meet tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock to go through the tax expenditure report and Senate File 2696. 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.